Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Vanity Fair.
You're on Tinder?
Yeah, I'm on Tinder.
Yo, who the fuck is on Tinder in Ennis?
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Chris Murphy.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are here to discuss part 3 of season 4 of the HBO series True Detective Night Country.
And later on, Isabella LeBlanc, who plays Leah, will be stopping by to talk about her frosty relationship with her stepmother, Liz Danvers.
But first, let's do a quick recap of part 3. Navarro and Danvers go through the evidence of Raymond Clark's fuck trailer and create a timeline of his relationship with Annie Kay. I forgot we coined fuck trailer.
Yes, we did.
It was a little weird, but he was crazy about her. But Annie changed when they started going out.
Changed how?
She didn't want anybody to know they were together. That was weird.
As Navarro joins the search for Raymond Clark, she is confronted with visions while she walks on the ice. She also gets a call that her sister is in trouble.
That's the water. The sea. I think stuff. Bad stuff. I know.
The only researcher found alive, Lund, awakes from his coma and has a very creepy message to deliver to Navarro.
Hello, Evangeline. Your mother says hello. She's waiting for you.
Junior Detective Pete Pryor cracks Annie Kay's cell phone, and a final video raises even more questions.
I just want to say, as we're starting, there's been this trend on TV shows, especially in the last 2 years. Maybe I'm just hypersensitive to it as somebody who gave birth in the last 2 years.
Yeah, I was thinking about you this episode.
Oh, thank you. Thinking of my labor
trauma,
experience.
Trauma, yeah.
Well, but that's the thing, right, is that all of the birth scenes that we've seen on prestige TV in the past 2 years especially have been dramatic and traumatic and, like, horrible and scarring.
House of Dragons, Dead Ringers. There were so many examples.
They just kept happening, and I was so thrilled to see a scene like that where it's intense, but then the baby is fine and the woman is also fine.
And it's fast between intense and fine.
Yes.
That moment is not dragged out, which I think is
which,
great.
Which, like, you know, as the two of you also know, is very true to life.
Right. Oh, yeah. I'm intimately.
Birth, obviously. Yeah. Very, very intense and very scary, but, you know, most of the time things do not turn out the way they do on television.
Yeah.
Or in recent TV, where there's been this overcorrection where it's like, for too long, you know, we skate past the nasty parts of womanhood and, you know, the female body. And so now we're going to lean way hard in the other direction. And we're just going to show, like, how awful it is all the time. And it's I feel like you can really tell that this was, like, made by a woman in that way.
Not putting a microscope on that. Though I will say that brief moment.
Awful.
Couldn't even
been brief.
Yes.
But are you implying that Nick Pizzolatto would not have written that scene?
Listen, that mother would have been topless, first of all.
Well, yeah, fair enough.
She would have, for some reason, been bouncing up and down.
Right. Oh. It would have been at some sort of sex party.
where, yeah, typical birth
environment. Yeah, where you give birth. Classic. You know.
I thought this was a really great way to meet Annie Kay.
Yeah.
You know, like in her element. We'd heard about her as being this kind of antagonizer of the mine and sort of just a troublemaker in the community. And, like, obviously, we were somewhat aware that, like, that was supposed to be not as actually negative as maybe Danvers thinks it is. But to have her living this life or doing this work behind literal closed doors that is so vital to the community and is so dwindling in the community, I think really establishes her as not some totally perfect, morally 100% righteous person, but as someone who was trying to do good in a place that seems very allergic to good.
Yeah, and especially, you know, rounding out her character in the way that a victim on a show like this doesn't get to be more than a name.
Yeah, and it also makes Navarro's kind of obsession with avenging her death make more sense, too, right?
Right,
because you see Navarro have this really powerful moment and experience watching Annie save a life, and knowing that Navarro couldn't do the same thing for Annie adds another layer into why she's so obsessed with this in the first place.
And it cuts through, I think, a lot of what we've seen from Navarro and Danvers. As, you know, they're pessimists. You know, she has her sister to care about. So there's that. And obviously Danvers has Leah and people. She cares about things, but they seem both very negative on, like, not just the human experience, but the human experience within this town.
Yeah.
And here's Annie, who is also probably pretty horrified by what she's seen in her community, given she protests all that. But she is at least trying to make things better and safer. And I don't always get the impression from Danvers and Navarro that that's really their top priority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I mean, when you look at the town, really dark.
Yeah.
It's getting really dark in Night Country. I would not go to Ennis if you gave me $1 million.
That's the thing, right? You do sort of watch and you're like, why are you still
just
there?
Get out of Alaska.
Leave. Yeah.
Like, go down south, go to Anchorage, go to
Juneau even.
Somewhere. Yeah, come on. Juneau has a good theater, a regional theater. Pioneer Theater.
And in this episode, we also learn more the vital piece of backstory, I think, that we've been missing between Navarro and Danvers, which is why their partnership dissolved in the first place with the Wheeler case.
True, but then we see Danvers lie about it.
Mm-hmm.
She lies about it to Peter Pryor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And is like...
Well, we still don't know the full story of what actually happened.
But if we're looking at the flashback,
it's clearly not
what she said. She said that the guy Wheeler, it was a murder-suicide, but then he turns in a very creepy way and, like, looks at Danvers and Navarro. So I'm like, why did she lie? What is that about?
Yeah, one of them definitely killed him.
I like the structure of that, where Danvers is telling this story to Pryor and it starts to flash back and you're like, okay, this is going to be the Rashomon version of the lie that Danvers is telling or whatever is going on with this guy, because she said he was dead. He was not dead.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that the show shows us something closer to what happened. Like, I think that's a good sort of, like, making Danvers an unreliable narrator, even in this moment where, like, the show doesn't need to, like, prove to us that she's not telling the truth. I don't know. I like that sort of juxtaposition.
Yeah, it's a show that doesn't underestimate the intelligence of its audience, which is nice to see.
Exactly. And I really like that at first I was a little nervous that, oh, these two cops, you know, harrowed by past experience and bad cases from the past was a little bit, like, familiar, let's say, maybe a little cliche. But I think in these two cases now, when we'll see what develops with the Wheeler thing, but, like, at least with Annie Kay, like, it's like, oh, okay, so this is actually, but these are distinct stories. Like, these are not just kind of your run-of-the-mill, a young woman was killed and I couldn't find her killer and I couldn't get over it. It's specifically this woman was killed and this person. And she also had this added damage of this other case that we're now getting some elucidation on. It just adds to the texture of the show in a way that makes it feel more specific and authorial rather than generic.
And it's all very thematically connected, you know, violence against women is a true detective hallmark, still is kind of the thread that runs through all of these different things.
But I do like, too, that we're sort of expanding to get into climate change in the mines and whatnot. I mean, with this episode, with Hank, who I go back and forth with him. I thought he was too dumb to have anything to do with it. And now this episode, I'm like, well, why didn't you say that you got a call about Annie and Clark.
Oh, right. He's hiding stuff.
He's hiding something, and it seems like he's protecting the minors, and which are by and large the white people. It's sort of becoming clear that it's, you know, white people versus indigenous people in terms of who wants the mine, who doesn't want the mine. And it feels like obviously Hank's on this side. Him and his, what are they, she always call them, his
hillbillies.
Cronies, his hillbillies.
Yeah.
And his hillbillies, who seem worthless, are totally in the mine's hand or the mine's interest or protecting the mine at the expense of Annie Kay. And I was like...
And we've seen in the past episode, like, Hank sending money to this woman in Russia or whatever. And it's like, is that just from his salary or maybe he's in the pocket of somebody?
Working with Salah. Like, we know.
Like, because clearly him, he was weird about the file. Then we find out about this phone call that maybe he dismissed unfairly as a crank call. But, like, it was kind of specific for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Clearly there is some obfuscation of.
Well, and he also, you know, Navarro says they want to find Raymond Clark, the escaped scientist, alive. And Hank's like, do we? And it's like, oh, do you not want him to?
Because he goes out with this like armed posse of civilians.
Is he going to tell on you?
Vigilante.
Right, exactly. And he says he's armed and dangerous. And it's like, we don't necessarily know
that at all.
Like, he could have been a victim. All of his colleagues are dead.
Well, not
clearly.
All of them.
Well, right. Oh, God. Back to the guy in the...
There is some body horror.
Yeah.
I watched this episode at 1 a.m.
Oh, no.
Why would you do that
I
to
don't know. I could not... I really didn't sleep because of...
Yeah. The noise that that Lund was making in bed and the way he moved... I mean, it was a monster movie.
Monster.
Yeah.
No, she's out. She's out there. In the ice.
Who's out there?
She came for us. In the dark.
Well, then he literally gets possessed by a demon, maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, does the creepy Michael Myers sit up straight, you know, with no arms needed.
Yeah, your mother says hello.
Yeah, like, right, yeah. I mean, okay, so let's talk about that moment and just the general supernatural. We're in episode 3 now. Like, how supernatural do we feel the show is getting? I mean, obviously, this is a town where people see ghosts. Maybe they're just crazy from the darkness or whatever. But that moment, that is pure Exorcism of Emily Rose.
That doesn't seem like the kind of thing you can really explain by anything other than it's a demon from hell.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
Who has possessed this man.
If Navarro is hallucinating that, she has worse problems than I thought. Yeah.
Like, she should maybe check out,
Into the Lighthouse, potentially.
Yes.
Like, it's interesting because I know we talked a little bit about how supernatural do we want it to get, and I'm moved and afraid and also enjoying the supernatural elements of the story. I do think that the actual mystery will be able to be revealed by science and logic and whatnot.
Right.
But I do think part of why it's set in Ennis, part of what we're doing here is exploring the spiritual implications of, you know, Western culture and Native culture and that clash. And what does that look like? And how that can, even if it isn't real per se, even if that man didn't, you know, really rise slowly and point into the distance, it felt real to Navarro. And that is... Mm-hmm. Maybe all that matters.
Yeah.
Whether or not he actually did that, if she saw that, that could have very real implications for how the case goes, what she ends up doing next.
That's true.
Yeah, like Navarro is losing it a little bit.
She's losing it.
That orange.
The orange that she throws and comes back.
Yeah. That's creepy. You know what? I never liked oranges.
No. That's and also I just love the visual oddity of seeing this bright, lovely fruit in the middle of this like darkened tundra hellscape. You know, I thought that was interesting. And there's something almost not biblical because that's an apple, but like there's something.
Well, it's from the Godfather, right? I mean, that's where like oranges signal death.
Is that right?
Oh, okay. Right.
Yeah,
that is.
Yeah.
When you see an orange in the Godfather movies, just buckle up.
Well, then
something's going
to
happen.
I'll have to rewatch with that in mind.
Okay, so do we think that all of Salah saw an orange and then they froze to death? Because we learned.
Well, no, that guy was making a ham sandwich.
Yeah, he was making a ham sandwich. But we learned this episode that they didn't freeze to death. That they froze after they died. They were startled to death or something.
Right. Something else happened to them, which is creepy. And we're also, you know, still wondering where this last scientist is. And from what the hairdresser says, she's like a little weird, but he wasn't creepy.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. And it seems to me like the hairdresser is wrong.
Right.
He seems really fucking creepy.
And like the whole thing about like, why is the relationship a secret? And they obviously had this RV set up out in the middle of nowhere.
Why was he fixated on her tattoo?
I just kind of feel like it's too obvious if the boyfriend did it in these circumstances.
Yeah.
But maybe that's the kind of double fake is that, like, it's telling us to look in all these different directions because it could never be this obvious. And then the reveal is that it is actually.
Oh, so yeah, that's the undoing.
Right, yes, exactly. The undoing. I knew there was some example rattling in my head.
HBO, yeah, 100%.
Yeah, but I don't know, because, like, I...
So what we're saying is that Hugh Grant killed Annie Kay.
Right, yes, exactly. Oh, sorry for the undoing spoiler.
I'm not. You should have seen that by now.
Seen it coming for sure. I thought it was interesting to go back to Salat, because now I'm, like, sort of obsessed with these scientists and how they died and whether or not they died. They're melting, the corpsicle melting, right? And we're seeing their limbs and whatnot. It reminded me of the caribous from the first scene. Mm-hmm. And them sort of all the caribous, like, moving, the very opening shot of the series. And I wonder if there's something with that in terms of them all dying out there and what they saw and whether or not there's a connection there.
I've started to think about how with global warming, climate change, when the tundra is thawing, all these diseases they fear are going to get released. And right. I'm almost wondering if, like, the mine accidentally tapped into something. And so there's, like, a psychological, like, there's some sort of...
It's like a rabies thing where makes you go nuts.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Like, because it feels like we see, yeah, why does the show start with these animals
running,
killing themselves, essentially? Why did, how did these guys end up there? And they,
Oh my God, is it The Happening? Is this M. Night Shyamalan?
I knew I had an example
happening
rattling around my head. Yeah, yeah.
It's in the air. It's the fog.
If that is the explanation, I will do a slow clap.
Yeah, because it feels so like funny. there's a mass psychosis, and I think that goes back to a bit like what Fiona Shaw's character was saying in an earlier episode, that this place is where the earth is cracking open, and like things are ending here, and wouldn't it make sense that some sort of malevolence that can be scientifically explained is being released by the cracking open of the earth,
which could scare you to death, like it scares a caribou, and like it's maybe scared all those scientists to death.
I mean, if that is the explanation, then everybody else in that town better watch out.
And everyone's hallucinating.
Yeah,
maybe there's something in the air. There's like a gas leak or something. Like,
I mean, Navarro's hallucinations can't entirely be explained because she's seeing visions of Jodie Foster's dead son. There's a little boy holding the polar bear, and we've seen Jody with the polar bear, and he says, "Tell my mommy." So that doesn't seem like, you don't have to be a true detective to put these pieces together. How would Navarro know? I mean, I guess Navarro knows Danvers, so she knows that she had a kid, but
that scene where she's running on the ice and slips, and because she sees someone out on the ice and she slips and falls and then is immediately in a dry place. She's in a deserty kind of looking place. Mm-hmm. But is that supposed to be the tundra thousands of years from now when all the ice is melted?
I just assumed that it was like a vision back
from
when she was
from the army.
Okay.
I assumed that it was army, but that could be, that could make more sense.
Oh, but if it's a Mad Max future, then that's a cool...
Maybe it's both. I don't know. Like what extreme polar opposites climate-wise, so...
Polar opposites.
There we go.
Does anybody ever call Danvers and Navarro polar opposites? I think that they should.
It better happen.
That better be what the finale episode is titled.
That would be like the network TV comedy trajectory.
And they're standing back to back with their arms crossed.
Rizzoli and Isles, the polar
opposites. She does it by the book.
Navarro and Danvers.
She threw the book out.
We didn't talk about the final cliffhanger in this episode, which is Pete actually managing to crack Annie's phone.
Yeah.
And we see a very terrifying or 10-second horror movie.
My name is Annie Kodok. If anything happens, please.
And like the screaming and the screaming. I mean, it's really brutal.
Yeah, the sound people this episode, whew. I mean, the breathing and then also the scream. Oh,
and to meet her at the beginning of this episode, so calm, cool, collected, knowing she's going to get arrested, but like, I got to get this thing done first. And then to have that be the last thing we see of her is her like in utter terror. Like, it's kind of like what Danvers and Pryor were talking about last episode, where it's like, what would make you so scared you ran out with your shoes on? What would make Annie Kay, who we've seen be very competent, collected, cool, like that scared,
And it does, I mean, it echoes, I'm sure intentionally, what happened right before all the scientists were killed, which raised the possibility that maybe the same thing killed both of them.
Yeah. Right, right.
Even though the scientist said she is back, right? Mm-hmm. Wasn't that what they said?
She's awake.
Yeah.
And
then Lund is in the bed screaming about how she's...
We woke her up
and all that stuff. And Danvers is like, you woke who up? And she won't,
And you know who really wasn't helpful? Oliver Tadek. When Danvers and Navarro go to that man in the shack mm-hmm. and is like, hey, you dated the hairdresser.
Yep.
Can you tell us anything? And then he freaks out once they're like, all of the Salaam men are dead. And then he says,
He
asks specifically about Lundy, so that has to be something.
Yeah, which is interesting because, like, we don't really know a lot of these people by personality or whatever beyond two at this point.
Yeah.
Like, and Lund, even we just know him because he's the one who's the boy who lived. Well, one of the boys who lived. To have this other guy like mention him by name specifically, that was interesting.
And I will say that was interesting to go back to the spiritual aspect of it. We do have Navarro saying that she never learned her Inupiaq name. Her mom mm-hmm. never told her that. And then Oliver basically calls her out for that.
Yeah.
2 seconds into that scene.
She feels pretty unfair. It's not like it's her fault.
It's pretty rude.
Yeah.
Pretty rude of him. And then kicks them out of the house. So I'm curious, maybe Oliver, I certainly didn't like him, what role that he played, because he knows more than he's saying.
He probably does, but he also seems kind of like a classic red herring. You know, they're going off, they're chasing this lead, they're going out far, you know, in that direction when maybe they should be going in the other direction entirely. Like, I don't know. I'm not convinced that he actually has much to do with the story because we're 3 episodes in, we have 3 left. Like, there's some time to spend before we can actually solve this.
It is interesting, though, that in little increments that we're learning that this lab and these scientists were not as cloistered as a lot of people thought.
Yeah.
They were like, no one comes in, no one goes out, that's
they're
it.
Getting their hair cut?
Well, no, there were the house cleaners. Two of them were dating people. Mm-hmm. Like, they were interacting with the community because how could they not? Everyone here is so lonely and horny and sad and broken. And like of course they're going to not leave the lab once in a while or have people come to them. I guess I'm just wondering, like, how much more involved were the lab people, the scientists in the community, specifically with the mine maybe or other, I don't know. I don't know who else. But like, their work was not as airtight, it seems, as we were told in episodes 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
So both Navarro and Danvers in this episode are dealing with their, well, troubled in one case and difficult in another. Danvers and Leah have some conflict here with
some family conflict.
Conflict that, you know, we're talking to Isabel LeBlanc for this episode, so I'll give a little more context for that. But like,
who plays Leah?
Who plays Leah? Like, she's exploring her heritage, and Danvers really doesn't want that. I'm assuming because she's like, if you act up, you're going to get hurt.
Yes, like Annie K.
If you want to get the tattoo on your chin at some other safer place, okay, fine. But you don't do that here because mm-hmm. it's too dangerous. You'll be seen as an Annie K type, and that's bad.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God, the scene with Jodie Foster wiping the tattoo off of Leah's face was so hard to watch because you can feel that Danvers doing that out of a mother's protection, out of a love, but it feels to Leah clearly like denying her identity.
Yeah, and a mother who has lost a child.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so is clearly, you know, very scared about losing another one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what Leah said ultimately seemed to get through or resonate with Danvers at least a little bit because Danvers went to the funeral for the stillborn baby. Mm-hmm. What that scene was really, the juxtaposition of that scene with the first scene with we have the successful birth, but then we have sort of the funeral for mm-hmm. the ceremony for the stillborn baby and that breathing soundtrack, that labor, it feels so connected to the mines and the water.
Yeah,
black water.
If we just have this community of Native women helping each other, like there is life. And then when the mine gets involved, like that has killed this child.
Yeah. And Danvers is blind to it and she doesn't care, says Leah, and then she finally has to sort of come face to face with it.
Yeah, and like this episode takes pains to show that Danvers has a particular way with children. She takes the hairdresser's daughter away.
When she makes
puddles,
a mac and cheese.
Yeah.
Mac and cheese thing, talks about Puddles the unicorn, obviously does seem genuinely bereft at the death of this baby. Like, there is a softness to her that she has had to turn off for whatever reason. And I think that, like, that's there in the conflict with Leah, where it's like Leah's a bit older, has more autonomy, can't just easily receive whatever love, care that Danvers is trying to give. And the wiping off of the tattoo, it's like, I don't know, it brings to mind the long and terrible history in the United States and Canada of Native children being taken from their family members and forcibly, quote unquote, assimilated into white culture. Mm-hmm. And is this image of a white woman wiping this thing off her Native daughter, you know, stepdaughter's face, like kind of evoking that in some ways? And so Danvers, as much as she cares about children, is still insensitively stomping all over the culture with women.
And probably also sees, like, you know, Leah embracing her birth culture as a rejection of Danvers.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And meanwhile, you know, Navarro's sister is perhaps more in tune with the things around her, not in a political level like Leah, but in a sort of more spiritual level, which might just be mental illness or whatever. And Navarro gets a phone call. It's the bar owner, right, I think?
Yeah.
And he says, she was talking about someone coming, someone on their way. So we're hearing more and more of this language of something approaching or having woken up. And I don't know. What do we think about where Navarro's sister is headed? It can't be anywhere good.
It's not. Yeah. I feel like that's the entire conversation. Yeah.
But how much of a bearing do we think it has on the events, the major action of the TV show? Like, is this just sort of, not just, but is it more of a foil to get at something deeper in Navarro? Or is something coming, is that have something to do with Salah? Does that have something to do with the deaths that have occurred?
Well, listen, if Julia's the murderer, then hats off, because wouldn't have seen that coming.
No, yeah. No.
But I'm thinking, now that I feel like we've leaned more into the supernatural and the spiritual world, I think that it's not just, Julia's not just sort of meant to be a device to get to know Navarro, but that something that is coming is real, mm-hmm. and it's coming for everybody, and everybody should be worried, and we should be, it's Cassandra. She sees something that we don't see. Mm-hmm. Something is happening to all of us.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Exactly. And I kind of feel like in her worldview, and perhaps it should be ours and those of the characters, oh, is the sun maybe never going to come back up? Like, has the world ended pretty much? And we're just kind of the last one staggering around before this thing comes and gets us. Or Julia just needs mental help and, you know, whatever. But I think that my hunch is that she will more sort of exist as a thematic part of the show rather than strictly involved with our murder mystery plot. But I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong.
But if she is.
Yep.
No, it would be a surprise.
It would be a surprise.
Yeah.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment, and when we return, a conversation with Isabella LeBlanc, who plays Leah, the stepdaughter of Liz Danvers.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jessie Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. Amid our supernatural murder mystery, there's also some really sort of intense family drama that's transpiring between Liz Danvers and her stepdaughter, Leah.
Yeah, it seems like Liz Danvers might be a tough woman to be raised by.
You don't say.
Yeah, so we've got some tension that we're dealing with. It boils over in this episode. Leah's exploring her culture. Danvers is not such a big fan of that.
Yeah. And I would also think that Jodie Foster is a tough screen partner. I mean, at least intimidating.
Oh, yeah.
So we wanted to go to the source to find out if that is, in fact, true. So we talked to Isabella LeBlanc, who plays Leah on the show, to hear about, like, what it is to work with Foster, to work with Issa Lopez, to be in the dark for however long she shot, which I think was a long time.
Months and months.
Again, couldn't pay me, but I'm very glad they made the show.
Yeah. But she's a lovely actor and a really great conversationalist. So enjoy that conversation.
Hi, Isabella.
Hello.
So, Isabella, can you tell us how you got involved in this season of True Detective? What was the audition process like?
Yeah, my audition process, I mean, from my end, felt very fast and furious. I think from their end, it was probably less so. But I think it was like around October of last year, I got asked to do a Zoom with Issa. We went straight to Zoom. I didn't do a self-tape, which is usually the thing. But I went straight to Zoom with Issa. And then a week later, they called that I booked it. And then I was on a flight to Iceland, I think like 2 or 3 days after that. So start to finish, it was all like a week and a half, maybe. Wow. And then next thing I knew, I was in Reykjavik.
Wow, that's wild. And how long were you filming there?
I mean, on and off for 6 months. Wow. I came home once over the holiday break, but otherwise, yeah, was hanging out over there.
And you're from Minnesota, so you didn't have to buy a whole new winter wardrobe, at least, in order to go.
No. Yeah. It was so funny. My manager, who's based in LA, she was terrified for me. She was sending me all these texts and messages being like, do you have boots? Like, they can buy you boots if you need. Like, if you need a winter coat, we can get you a winter coat. I was like, oh, no. Been there, done that.
This is nothing for me. Yeah, yeah.
I'm built for it, yeah.
When did you know that Jodie Foster was going to be playing your stepmother?
I knew it, like, when I was auditioning. Wow. Okay. So when I was, like, doing these sides, I was like, oh, and this would be me talking to Jodie Foster, which just felt wild. And I don't think that was ever something I thought I would get cast as. Obviously, we look very similar, so.
How would you describe Leah as a character? I mean, she's obviously working through several kind of conflicts in her life between her and her stepmom, between her and her culture. How does she kind of look to you when you're kind of interpreting her?
Yeah, there's like normal teenage stuff, and then there's stuff that a teenager doesn't always have to deal with at the same time.
Yeah, it's funny. When I've been finding when I like talk to people about Leah, and I've been seeing in some of the talk about the show, is like everyone describes her as troubled, like this troubled teenager. And I'm like, I don't know if Leah's that troubled. Like, all things considered, I think she's like got a really solid head on her shoulders. I think she is just like at a really difficult age where you're like, you're not an adult, but you're definitely not a kid anymore. And as a Native kid who's being raised by like a white stepmom, I think she is, you know, really grappling with a lot of like, what's her truth and what's other people's truth? And she's definitely rebelling, and she definitely has her moments, but, you know, she's not rebelling for the sake of rebelling. I think she has a really strong moral compass, which I kind of admire about her. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really been so wonderful to see Leah sort of wrestle between these two worlds and try to connect with her Native identity, but then also deal with her stepmom who is raising her. And there's this really wonderful moment in this episode where Jodie Foster, Liz Danvers, wipes off these markings from Leah's face, and it gets sort of physical and it's really sort of hard to watch. Can you talk a little bit about filming that scene with Jodie Foster and how that went down?
Jodie's like just such a generous scene partner, but it was so funny because she's so much shorter than me. And so we would go to like film this scene where she's like really intimidating me, and she's like, she's very scary and she's a looming presence, and I feel like I'm like towering over her, which was fun and cool to play with, because I do feel like, you know, Liz is just as intimidated by Leah as Leah is of Liz. And so it was really cool to get to feel like kind of the back and forth on that, and feel the moments in which like Leah kind of has the reins, and when she's kind of able to like stop the record. And then when Liz kind of jumps in and takes over again. And so it was like, as an actor, a really exciting moment to kind of explore. And yeah, and Jodie's wonderful. And yeah, it's such a pivotal part of Leah's journey, and kind of a heartbreaking one.
Mm-hmm. What were your first interactions with Jodie like? I mean, she's your primary scene partner, and that must be a little intimidating for anybody, you know?
Definitely. But I guess she's like very chill. Like it doesn't feel like it should be possible to be kind of so cool and so talented and so just like easy to be around. But I felt really lucky that we got some table work time in the weeks before we started shooting. And so we got to kind of work through some scenes together, talk through some scenes. We really bonded over football. Apparently Jodie loves football, and I'm a Minnesota Vikings fan.
Wow.
So there's a lot of fantasy football mother-daughter bond.
That's just like the show.
Exactly. Art imitates life.
We love that.
When you're filming this stuff, like, you know, obviously Leah's getting involved in these protests against the mining company, and that seems a lot of significance to the show. But do you know how the storyline fits into the grander mystery? Did they tell you that, or are you kind of, no pun intended, in the dark?
I knew. I had gotten to read all the scripts, and I was just like so moved by this whole parallel between Leah and this case that Danvers is working on. But it wasn't really until like halfway through the shoot that Nivi, who plays Annie Kay, was in the makeup trailer with me. And I kind of saw her, and I was like, wow, that kind of looks like me. And Richard, our first on set that day, he was like, wow, you guys like really look like each other. And that was not quite a connection I had made, is like how much of Leah I think that Danvers could see in Annie Kay and vice versa. And so that was kind of exciting to get to see in the finished product.
And then, well, so you're in Iceland, you're shooting, it's always nighttime. I'm assuming it actually is cold outside.
Did it feel, were you like, I'm ready for this because I'm from Minnesota, then you get there and it was like, oh shit, this is actually like more intense, or was it actually something you could handle?
I was so humbled. I like really came in guns a-blazing thinking that it was going to be like piece of cake. And it's really intense. It's really wild. And the sunlight, that's the big one. And like here in Minnesota, like we still get the sun pretty much all day during the winter, and not having the sun, it does things to you. Mm.
Yeah. Did you start seeing dead people?
Oh yeah.
You know, every day. Normal shooting stuff. What was it like working with Issa? I mean, you know, she's coming from one perspective, you're coming from another, Jody's from another. Like, what were the conversations like about the themes of this season? Because it is heavy in theme and in a really fascinating way. And I'm just curious, like, how much that was spoken about during production.
I love Issa. I adore her. And I really appreciated the space she made immediately, like right off the bat. Again, like I was coming off of this like kind of crazy fast audition process. I was all of a sudden in another country, and I basically like got off the plane and went to meet with Issa. And she was like, she basically had just asked, she was like, who's Leah to you? Like, who's the Leah you know? Who is the Leah in your community? And we were able to have some really candid conversations from the beginning about like what it felt like for me to grow up as an Indigenous teenager, what I see in like my young family members now. And so it felt like there was always the space for that truth. And Issa was never going to try to tell me that, but she was always going to make space for me to find it. And it really always just felt like rising to her occasion, and that like she would set up these scenes for me and then she would trust me to figure out how to find what my truth in it was. And that felt like a big gift. And I felt that in Jody too, and that like she was just always understanding that, like, you know, that she wasn't going to get Leah in the way that I was. And so making sure that Leah got to remain truthful was something that we all kind of held together.
Was it meaningful for you to be acting alongside so many other Indigenous actors, particularly the large company of Indigenous women?
Oh, it was incredible. I feel like so often in this world, it like ends up that I'm the only Native person in a room or in a cast. And it feels like a whole different world to be doing it alongside people that like, you know, understand where you come from and understand what your values are. And I really feel like I gained a new community, and like the Alaska Native community that I got to meet, and the Canadians that I got to meet. Like I feel like so lucky that I got to go on this journey with them. It felt really good.
You can really feel that, I think, watching the show, you know, that it may be an overused term, but there was something like a sort of safe space on this set. And like, while these heavy, heavy stories are being told, was there fun involved though? I mean, 'cause this is really dark subject matter for a lot of the the episodes we've seen thus far. But I feel like sometimes I talk to actors and they say the darkest things are actually weirdly the most fun to film. How did this shake out for you?
Oh, this one was a blast. And it like almost feels like bad to say that, like I'm like a bad actor thing to say. But it was just like always fun with this team. And even like, you know, on the days that we're shooting, like the scene where like, yeah, Jody's and I are fighting and wiping off the lines. Like, again, we're just talking about fantasy football in between takes. Like, it's just like a great set. It was a great vibe. The whole crew was wonderful. We got to see so much of Iceland. Finn, who plays Peter Pryor, and I were kind of like the two series regulars, young ones that were there for kind of the whole shoot. So we became buddies and got to see the little island country together. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, because if it would have been a really heavy, you know, experience between takes and then it's dark all the time, I think maybe you really would start to see dead people. Like it would be a little too much.
Exactly.
You did get a chance to see how the show ends. Before you started filming it, were you surprised by the mysteries reveal?
I was like blown away from the beginning. I remember the moment of reading the last episode and just being totally blown away. Like I definitely didn't see any of it coming. And then it was so lovely to then get to do like our table reads, which were the first three episodes, I believe, and getting to like go back and hear everyone read, knowing how it ended. It was just like delicious and amazing and so cool.
You shot this now a little bit of time ago, so you've had many months of having to keep secrets. When the show's airing, I mean, how hard is it? I'm sure you're going to have tons of family members and friends begging you for answers, and you're not going to be able to give them, right?
Exactly. I have a cousin who has a few theories that he's just like convinced of in this season. Like every time I see him, he's like, well, this is going to happen, right? And I'm like, sorry, I can't say anything.
Can't say.
I don't want to lose my job.
Well, without giving anything away, I mean, we have an opening credit sequence that's chock full of interesting imagery, and then the show itself, you know, has various symbols and things like that. Is there any little detail you can say that we as audience members would be wise to pay attention to, or is that even that giving too much away?
That's a great question. Let me think very carefully about this one.
I wouldn't want to get you in trouble. It can also be a diversion if you want to lie to us. That's fine.
We won't know.
A red herring.
A red herring. I'll say that I think to pay attention to the things you don't have to pay attention to.
That's good. That's cryptic and good. Yeah, that's really
like it.
That sounds like something that you would hear a True Detective say.
Yeah.
Ask the right question.
Exactly.
Ask the right questions.
There you go. Yeah, that's my Liz Danvers impression.
Well, Isabella, thank you so much for talking with us. We really appreciate it. And congrats on this amazing project. It's such a joy to be back in a True Detective world, but from a different perspective this time around. And obviously, you're a huge part of that. So we really appreciate your time.
Oh my goodness. Thank you so much. This is so lovely. Thank you for having me.
Still watching, we'll be right back. And when we return, we're going to give our predictions for who we think the murder or murderers are.
The Run for Revogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
As ever, we're going to end the show with our whodunit section, where we make a prediction about, well, whodunit. Mm-hmm. I can lead off because I kind of already said it in this episode. I think it's some sort of gas or chemical that has driven people to varying degrees of insane and thus tearing eyeballs out and, you know, making people run into the snow. So in a weird, almost anticlimactic way, I don't think there is a single villain except the mine. Like, it's, but there's not like a murderer. That's my guess. Mm-hmm. At least for the scientists. Obviously for Annie Kay, that was a straight up murder. Mm-hmm. So that,
unless the gas can cut people's tongues out
and stab them 32 times. Kind
of, but maybe it makes someone do that.
It's also possible.
So, okay. I'm going to say that it's some sort of gas, but also Clark maybe did kill Annie Kay.
Mm-hmm. Maybe also Clark. Ugh, okay. Wow. I got to put on my Jodie Foster, Ariana Grande detective hat. As she said, Ariana Grande.
Yeah, she did.
2016. And that, I will say, that song that came out, or that album, Dangerous Woman, that seems to be thematically important.
Ooh.
Right?
That's also just good detective work, honestly.
It really is. I'm going to go with my, and this is probably wrong, but I'm going to allow myself to take a big swing here. And I don't think Julia did. I don't think Julia hurt anybody, but I do think she's right that she's seeing something that is going to happen, that is something supernatural, real. That polar bear with the one eye is still, polar bears, I don't know. I think maybe it's like a beast of some kind. And rather than it being a ghost, maybe it is some sort of...
So I feel like it represents Danvers' dead kids, like, familiar, because he had the polar bear,
stuffed animal.
It's, like, very hard for me not to say a stuffy, because
is that what they call them now?
That is how you refer to stuffed animals if you're a child.
I think, okay, that's fair. I'm going to say it's more insidious. I'm going to say that polar bear and that with the eye, I think there's maybe an animal, a beast, some sort of real...
Oh, and that's the killer.
And when they say we woke her up, they don't say it's a person.
They don't say this is a she. They say she's awake.
Yep. Can a virus be a she?
Yeah, it's like an old... It's like sailing ships. Yeah.
Yeah. And corvettes. Yeah.
Okay. You guys are leaning away from people, so I guess I should say that it was... I feel like Andy, like, it's so obvious that it would be Clark, but, like, it's so obvious that it would be Clark kill her. So I just feel like I got to stick with that. And for the deaths of the scientists, I mean, look, if it is somehow the spirit of Annie Kay killing them, like, that's pretty cool. So maybe I'm actually leaning toward the supernatural again.
And maybe the spirit of Annie Kay is gas, or maybe it got into
like
the polar
bear. Like Hexus and Fern Gully.
Yes, exactly. Wow, it could be.
So I don't know, because there's more supernatural stuff happening. Like, people are seeing stuff that isn't there. So the demonic possession of Lund, she's awake. Like, if Annie Kay is somehow a ghost and she is somehow murdering men.
Her spirit.
I do feel like that kind of fits in with the themes of the show.
Annie Kay might be a dangerous woman to these men.
Mm-hmm. All right. Ariana Grande. You heard it from Ariana first.
Ariana Grande.
Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. As ever, you can find me on social media at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on social media at Christress.
You can find me at Hillabuster.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday for episode 4. Looking forward to seeing you then.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR. From PR.